Okay. So what we're going to talk about tonight is end-of-life issues. We've discussed it some length previously, so spend some time going over some of the sources we discussed previously and hopefully adding different interpretations. I want to begin by setting a philosophical framework for what we've tried to accomplish in the end-of-life research medical ethics. To begin by mentioning three books that, if you're interested in the field, I think would be really valuable for you to read. One, which is my absolute favorite book in medical ethics, is by Benjamin Friedman. The name is Duty and Healing. Just an absolutely wonderful book that really transformed my vision of what medical health, Jewish medical ethics should be. The second is Jewish philosopher named Boris, Jewish medical ethicist named Boris Brody. He has many, many books out. He has many books out. The one that I definitely fell in love with is called Taking Issues. And it's a collection of essays, most of which are not explicitly Jewish. Well, the fun of it is that if you read Talmud, you can sort of feel them, read Talmud in the background. And in some places, he explicitly relates, at the end of the book, he explicitly relates what he's doing with no reference to Judaism in many of the essays to the Jewish argument at the end of it. And the third, is by the speaker, I think, that you're having next week, and will be an excerpt from Yaron Zohar, Alternative Jewish Dialectics. Same series of questions that we're using in particularly useful ways. Okay, so I want to begin by talking about the purpose and the audience of Jewish medical ethics, which I think are connected. And for whom is one doing Jewish medical ethics, and what is one trying to accomplish to be answered by the Jewish medical ethics? So for me, I'm going to divide the world into three groups of people. These are the potential audiences of Jewish medical ethics. One is those Jews who see Jewish law as binding on them, halakhically observant Jews. Second is people who identify as Jewish but don't see Jewish law as binding on them. And the third are people who identify as Jewish. I want to set out the way in which Jewish medical ethics would change depending on whom you're trying to do them for. Again, these are obviously very broad strokes, but I think it's useful because many differences will, I think, be explained better if you understand how they shift in terms of audiences. But I think if you're addressing an audience that works with the premise that Jewish law is binding on them, and then you can make ethical arguments, Jewish ethical arguments that are framed entirely in what I would call coherence terms. So there's these one swap measures, right? There are, I like to talk about three criteria for truth: coherence, correspondence, and coolness. There is a graphic coolness for now, it's not relevant to tonight's discussion. Correspondence means that you already have the standard of truth, and you're evaluating the outcomes of a particular epistemological framework as to how it corresponds to the things you already know. Coherence means that you agree that the system works entirely in and of itself, and the only question is this the answer which is properly produced in accordance with this system of thought? So if you're addressing an audience that believes that halakha is binding on them, then you can make an argument which is justified entirely by the internal logic of halakha. Whether that logic corresponds to any pre-existing or external ethical framework, whether the type of argument makes any sense, or even for that matter, the outcome makes any sense in any specific halakha, can be irrelevant. So I'll give you what in the internal logic of halakha would be called an opinion, a practical difference as to whether you care about coherence and correspondence. This is drawn from Friedman. So you're asked the question, is it permitted to donate blood? Now, why would it not be permitted to donate blood? If you don't know what blood, obviously you can't donate blood. Because you're right, because there's a prohibition against self-wounding, and in the internal logic of halakha, wounding is defined as drawing blood. And so obviously, right, Jewish medical ethics prohibits donating blood to others. However, the Talmud also talks about how, at least on certain days of the week, because it depends, it depends on which day of the week, because there are astrological phenomena that are relevant to this, as well as sociological and cultural criteria, on what days of the week it's permitted to engage in bloodletting as a medicinal practice. Now, one can make the argument entirely within the internal logic of the system that since the Talmud permits bloodletting on the Shabbat, on, say, Tuesdays and Thursdays, therefore blood donation, right? So therefore the Talmud really allows blood donations on Tuesdays and Thursdays, so the patient can less blood. Okay, now that works perfectly well in the internal logic of the system, but it has absolutely no interest to somebody who has an interest in the substantive results of the process as opposed to whether you're using the system appropriately. So that's the kind of argument that would show up if you're doing Jewish medical ethics for Jews who take halachas binding, and that really is the Epicurean interest outside that framework. Now that may seem like that was a fun example and it's easy to make it readable, but there's a better example that you talked about last week, which is criteria for death. And so do we define death by cessation of respiration or cessation of cardiac activity? Now those are based, you can have definitions of the past, but those definitions of the past are based on what was known at that time and what was reasonable, and it may be that to attempt to make arguments on that basis as to whether brain dead should be considered death or not, right, really should only matter to people whose sole interest is functioning within the system and there's not really a substantive interest, and is one of interest in ethics at all. Okay, I think that's worth thinking about. I talked about brain death, but I haven't at length, so we can talk about that at some point in discussion with my own idiosyncratic, probably anti-scientific position. Are about that. Are we talking about now? So if I get those 10-second things, you get back to later, I don't think there is such a thing. It doesn't measure anything. That form to create organ transplant. Alright, now today. We can fight about that later. It doesn't mean that Talafah shouldn't recognize it, just one shouldn't think that it measures anything other than just science and genetic organs. The second thing is that when you are doing Jewish medical ethics for an audience of people of high binding, then what you're making, I would say, and I apologize for the fuzzy terms, not just a normative, but a legal claim. And what I mean by that, and there are better terms I could use for it, but I think these will work, is that often the purpose of law is to remove discretion. And the purpose of law is to tell you exactly what to do and not to give you any choice. Right, not to leave room for your own decision, as opposed to ethical norms, which often just give you a framework that are designed to enable you to exercise your discretion. So if you're doing Jewish medical ethics for an audience to take halakha as binding, it's often you'll find that what people are trying to do is to remove discretion, to enable people to act with certainty, and to, in some sense, pass the responsibility off onto the system. Whereas if you're dealing with an audience that doesn't assume that halakha is binding on them, so that's never going to happen, right? You never remove your discretion. You always have the decision about whether they accept the framework or not. And so making claims that precise, removing discretion by itself is very rarely a purposeful goal. So when you do Jewish medical ethics for that audience, you often find people trying to be as precise, as rigorous, as creating detailed criteria as possible. If you're doing it for a different audience, then that often is just off-putting. Because you'll find it, because people are making too many close calls are being made when you look at them like, why do you need to make that call? Why do you leave that one up to me? Okay. If you're dealing with an audience of people who identify as Jewish, but don't think halakha is binding, so then coherent arguments by themselves are often insufficient. Although you can make an argument from traditional practice, and they'll say, "I want to do this because this is how it has always been done." Now the difference between a coherent argument and arguments about the way it has always been done, this will matter a lot in the middle part of the presentation is whether you're interested in intellectually creative reading of past sources. If you're making a coherence argument, you can say, well, you know what? It seems to me that we've been misreading this source since around the year 1300 or so. And if we just go back, we discover that 700 years ago, the proper reading of the primary text on this is that, although we've done it wrong for the past 700 years, that's useful, interesting from a coherence perspective. It's not at all really interesting from a tradition perspective, because you're admitting openly that you're doing something that just haven't done for the past 700 years. You have to, again, be right. So that kind of argument has much more interest. If you think Caliphate is binding, you're more likely to be seeking against guidance rather than specific dictates. And the last distinction is that you're still not terribly interested in whether the outcomes are the same for Jews or non-Jews. So you're dealing with an internal discourse about what Jewish medical ethics says for Jews, and if it happens that the outcome the halakhic system says something else about non-Jews, that doesn't matter to you, it's not part of the discourse. If you're trying to make, however, an argument that goes beyond the Jewish community, you're trying to make Jewish medical ethics part of a conversation about the American, right, about the American medical system, or about what, right, about the way in which a hospital should function. And you're making an argument not because of a particularistic basis that the interests of your community need to be defended, but you're making an argument because you want people to consider this as at least a real option as to what the right thing to do and the right way to think about it is. And if you're not internal to the Jewish community at all, then you have a whole set of other issues. First of all, you have to make only rationally accessible arguments. Any arguments that only make sense of the system are entirely irrelevant. Why should anybody care? It might be that you will come to conclusions based on coherent arguments, which you can then defend on correspondence terms. Say, Jewish law allows blood donations even though there's a possibility of self-harm. And that even if the way you allowed that was by analogy to bloodletting, which has no interest to anybody, but you can defend the result. But the arguments you have to make in that context have to be correspondence arguments as opposed to coherence arguments. Now that means that your interpretational choices are going to be shifted, because sometimes you can get the different results by coherence arguments than you can by correspondence arguments, and if you're limited, then it limits your choices. Secondly, I think that in that framework you have to use what American law calls strict scrutiny to any outcome differences between Jews and non-Jews. If you're making an argument that's supposed to apply to general American public policy, and you say that, well, we think medical ethics should be this way for Jews, but that way for non-Jews, you're not part of the conversation. Americans, right? Unless you have a really, really, really good defense as to why certain things should be different, it takes at least the same level of defense as the racial distinction, particularly the racial distinction that has invidious impact on minorities, would have to take an American constitutional law. And that also radically shapes the possibilities you have in Jewish medical ethics, because there are lots of things you can do if you're only talking about Jews, right, that you have to give entirely different explanatory frameworks. If you agree that the outcome has to be the same for Jews and non-Jews, the easiest way of framing this is abortion, right, where you'll find that many presentations of Jewish medical ethics work on the premise that abortion is considered murder for Gentiles but not for Jews. And that just doesn't work. That's not right. You're not part of the conversation about abortion in America. And if you make a claim like that. But it would not be honest, right? It would not be honest to say that that isn't a very real, possibly the dominant traditional voice in Halakha, right, at least for the last 300-400 years, has been that abortion at a certain point in the process is a more serious offense for Gentiles than for Jews. Right, so those are methodological frameworks that we have to set out in advance. Part of the Another way, I guess, of framing this is set out in the passage that I gave you from Noam Zaro's book. Just circling it back. And I said, some people wonder whether they can be, whether they can't. Are we going to give you enough yet? Okay. It'll be a brief book. Okay. So Zohar asks the question as follows, and it says, some people wonder whether they can be Jewish at least. The doubt cannot, however, be answered simply by an invitation to enter a library like one upstairs and note the various relevant titles, or by pointing to the vast tradition of Jewish knowledge discourse stretching back across the millennia. Mm-hmm. Although they recognize all this, their doubts persist, reflecting not a lack of information or reservations about basic premises. These reservations converge from both sides. On the one hand, there is a universal objection which argues that ethics excludes any filial explanation. On the other hand, is what we call the divine authority objection, which says that Jewish precludes an attachment to critical moral deliberation. Right, so the argument he sets up is that if we say that ethics is by something universally accessible, then there can't really be anything Jewish. Right? All Judaism can be is information about how everybody ought to act. There's really no such thing as unique, right, as Jewish medical ethics that works within the Jewish framework. On the other hand, you can claim ethics requires the capacity to verify it, right, to verify statements on the basis of universally available information. Then Judaism isn't really ethical because Judaism assumes that what Jewish tradition says is correct. So it's not clear that you can meet that test of producing Jewish medical ethics that in fact are universally relevant. All right, that's the challenge. The challenge you set out. Another way of framing that is, you can say that with Jewish about medical ethics is ethical, and with ethical about it isn't Jewish. Okay. Now I want to come up with yet another way of framing this, which I think matters, which is the question of whether there is a difference between Jewish medical ethics and medical halakha. Many presentations of Jewish medical ethics are actually presentations of Jewish medical halakha. Right, where the outcomes they give are all specific mandates, and they have no implications beyond the specific mandates. Right, they tell you, within the frame of questions that these traditions deal with, this is what the outcomes have to be. And any case which doesn't fall within this framework is a totally new question about which we have done nothing. It doesn't tell you anything about what the value behind it are. And so, for example, if you look at works like the Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics, you'll find that that almost entirely, while it's called Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics, even its introduction will tell you that it thinks the difference between Jewish medical ethics and non-Jewish medical ethics is that Jewish medical ethics are about law. And they tell you, right, and they tell you exactly what to do, and they don't allow for multiple options and things like that. The three books I cited at the outset, are an attempt to present an entirely different position, which says that you can do Jewish medical ethics without necessarily having as your outcome a set of mandates which people are compelled to conform to. In Friedman's book, what he sets out at the opening, he says, what I'm trying to do in this book, and he was functioning as a clinical ethicist in a series of Canadian hospitals which had no Jewish affiliation at all. So he said his premise, or at least trying to accomplish, is to present Jewish tradition in a way which is universally relevant. And that's a major interpretational choice, and that will cause you to say different things about the tradition than you would if you had a different goal. Now, I'm going to set out the framework for what I'm going to try to accomplish in the section after dinner is I'm associating myself with Friedman. And what I want to do is I want to present a vision of Jewish medical ethics that is universally defensible. And it may be that I will use coherence arguments to show that this is what the tradition's result is. But I want to make arguments about, right, let's say as a standard, I want to make arguments that are universally relevant, and that also means that I will be strongly biased against arguments that make distinctions between Jews and between Jews and non-Jews. Now I have to say one more thing, and then I think that we're almost at the break. He wrote a text which is a tremendously important text. That's source number 2. The Talmud there is engaged in a live discussion as to a live discussion in the sense that the action that it was took place at a time when there was sufficient persecution that you actually had to decide which Jewish activities you were willing to die for or not. And they had an active discussion about what things you have to die for, and they end up with a list of at least three, right? The three being something that involves bloodshedding, some conflict of sexual kind, and some conflict of the illicit forms of worship. It roots the obligation to die before performing certain types of illicit forms of illicit religious acts explicitly in a biblical verse. The source that teaches you, however, that you have to give up your life rather than shed someone else's blood, the Talmud says at the end, is right. This is the source. How do we know that you can't heal by bloodshedding, or you can't save, right? You can't save a life by killing somebody else? That is smart. That's a rational argument. There's a very famous phrase in tradition: "Who says that your blood is better than his?" And that to me is crucially important, because it tells you that some form of universally accessible intuition is at the core of the way halakha functions. You might think that the question of what you have to die for is the kind of issue that if you God bothers to reveal himself, he should tell you something about it. But he doesn't in this case. He just leaves it. I tend to think the argument is that anybody who doesn't realize this on their own, no text in the world is going to save their soul. Right, they'll find a way to prevent anything. So we just left this one out because it's just sort of a test whether you belong as part of the system or not. So in that way, that text is a very powerful legitimization of correspondence arguments, right, arguments that the outcome of the Jewish medical ethics act rationally acceptable. At the same time, the text then goes on to say that by means of a literary juxtaposition, we then derive from that you have to give up your life rather than commit adulterous rape, which is not as immediately rationally acceptable. It leads to all sorts of results which are certainly not rationally obvious, like the notion that you have to 150 people perhaps have to die rather than shed one person's blood, and it's a very good argument. That the 150 people's blood raised if you concentrated it, right, you know, would be richer in the same volume, than one person's blood. So on the one hand, that text is powerful as a legitimization of that kind of argument. On the other hand, it's a really good illustration of the limits of that type of argument, because one of the papers I often assign to students is to try and explain all the halakhot that contradict this principle. And basically much of Jewish law, Lifeblood Ethics, is about exceptions to this principle. We start with the very basic thing that you're allowed to kill. If A is trying to kill B, you're allowed to kill A to kill B. What? Because one, right, how do you know that A is better than B? Oh, because A is guilty. Oh, okay, so that's not the rational, right? What happens if A is smarter? What happens if, right, so you've already broken down the principle. So on the one hand, I think that text is really, really valuable because it tells you that rational argumentation is an inescapable part of Jewish medical ethical conversation. And on the other hand, it tells you that to just reduce Jewish medical ethics to rationally accessible conversation is right. That isn't the full account of it. Okay, so that's the introduction, and we'll come back after dinner and we'll talk about it in the way that should specifically.